Our first case is case number 581-01, Jason McCarty versus the State of Nevada. We have Mr. Orm representing the appellant, Mr. DiGiacomo representing the state, the respondent. And we have 60-minute oral argument today. On this case, it is a direct appeal of a death penalty, which are always 60-minute oral arguments, at least in the initial direct appeal. So at this time, Mr. Orm, did you wish to reserve any time in your for rebuttal?
Well, I've asked to reserve 10 minutes.
You may reserve 10 minutes. And we have six justices here. Justice Seda is not here today. She will participate in the decision of this case and listen to the oral argument as well.
Yes, sir.
Okay.
And you may May I please court, Christopher Orm on behalf of appellant Jason McCarty. In this case, that sentence and all of his convictions, it's really quite simple, must be reversed, and it's really one of the most basic decisions I think that is ever necessary. In this case, Powell versus Nevada is probably the most important case that we can look at. In Powell, in 1994, the United States Supreme Court considered a decision from this court. And here in Powell, Powell had been sentenced to death for killing a child. He was brought to jail, was not brought before a magistrate. Within that four-day period before he was brought to a magistrate, he confesses or makes incriminating statements. The state of Nevada said that that was acceptable. The court said it was acceptable. The United States Supreme Court, sua sponte, reversed, saying you must bring a defendant to a magistrate within 48 hours. That's in 1994. 30 years later, well, it was 1989 when the case happened, we have Jason McCarty. He's arrested, and the state of Nevada does not dispute in their briefs, nor did they dispute at the lower court, that he is kept in custody for 13 days without seeing a magistrate. In that time, Jason McCarty makes numerous statements. They were all played for the jury, and the statements were very, very damaging, including being brought out to the desert. There's video of him being brought out to the desert where he's searching for instrumentalities of death. He's telling the police facts about the case that are just so damaging, and what I guess the state says is exculpatory. Do we know it's exculpatory? The state cited to his statements 17 times in the guilt phase during the rebuttal argument. 17 times. They played his statement 7 times. They didn't bring him to a magistrate for 13 days. I don't know what else could be more obvious. And what concerned me is in the litigation below, I raised so many issues of why there should have been suppression of the statements. I felt it was lost. And so in the reply in this court, I tried to make it so clear to the court that that was the basis of what I was complaining about. How do you secrete someone in our jail, keeping them away from counsel, keeping them away from a magistrate? And there are some quotes from this court that I would like to read. And this is coming from this court citing to McNabb versus United States. This is a 1983 case of Berman. The purpose behind NRS 171.178 is to prevent resort to those reprehensible practices known as the third degree, which, though universally rejected as indefensible, still find their way into use. It aims to avoid all the evil implications of secret interrogations of persons accused of crime.
Mr. Sherman, we're looking at the timeline here now. When the sentence you're talking about with Mr. McCarty, when was he formally arrested by the police and placed into custody?
I argue it was May 25th when he was taken behind a 7-Eleven. There was some contention over whether that first statement should be suppressed. He was handcuffed and formally arrested on that day. It just depends on when the state wants to admit it. Was at the beginning of the statement or towards the end of the statement? But there is no argument that it happened after May 25th. He was taken over to the Henderson jail.
And on May 23rd, there had been an application for a search warrant supported by a sworn statement that he was a suspect as of May 23rd. Is that correct?
Saying he was responsible for the deaths of both of these women? That's correct. So they knew it. They absolutely knew it. And the detective didn't dispute it during the evidentiary hearing. Yes, he was a suspect. Only the state in their brief tries to claim, oh, no, he was just maybe going to be a witness, which is belied by the record and belied by what you just said. But what's even more curious to me, and I think a little more difficult to understand, is while he's in jail and not being brought to a magistrate, Scott Mitchell from the district attorney's office is communicating with the lead detective, telling him information and saying, go and talk to Jason McCarty. Ask him this. Ask him that. And they go back and forth. In fact, Detective Collins testified in the statement, with Jason McCarty. He said, well, DA thinks you're lying. DA doesn't believe you.
But he had been read as Miranda rights at that time, hadn't he?
He was read as Miranda rights. On May 25th, at page 142 of his recorded statement, that's when they Mirandized him.
Okay.
There's no dispute that in jail he was Mirandized. Absolutely. But by that point, he wasn't brought by a magistrate, which mm-hmm. violates power. Violates 171.178.
And when was it June 7th that he was brought to a magistrate?
That's correct. He okay. was brought to the magistrate in Henderson.
And that was his first encounter with the judicial officer?
Correct. So you have this 13-day period, which, as I said, the state doesn't even seem to dispute. And so I can't quite understand what everybody was thinking in this case. It seems so obvious. But to think that a DA was over there sending the detectives in is very, very troubling. And it is sort of a side note, but I, at the time when the court ruled that the statements were inadmissible, I said, well, at least take out the portion where the DA is saying he's a liar, and they said, oh, that's coming in too. And to me, it just seemed, you know, sort of outrageous that this was occurring. It causes me great concern that when I see the state's response about my argument with regard to the 48-hour rule, on page 16 of their answering brief, they say, they cite a case, and it's sort of their conclusion on this issue, noting that while a 19-month delay between initial detention and arrest occurred, the remedy did not rest with Sixth Amendment, rather the statutory speedy trial. And so it made me curious, and that's why I was citing to Hamadi. Do they think that they're running, obviously, and I don't mean to overstate it because I have such a good issue, but it's like Guantanamo Bay. You know, if we're arguing about an enemy combatant who's being kept there without any type of judicial process, maybe they have an argument. But this is a domestic crime with a man charged and placed in jail, a man without a high school education, by the way. He didn't graduate high school. And they've got him in there. And the DA's telling him, hey, look at this information. Maybe you could, you know, help us out. All of those things. The DA thinks you're a liar. It's appalling and it's obvious. Suppression was mandatory here. And I want to dovetail it with another issue that I raised. And that was, within moments of my opening argument, I asked the judge, I said, there's a Glover decision issued by this court. And in the Glover decision, it would be defense misconduct to talk about the defendant's statements. Well, as I saw it, the defendant's statements were the most incriminating part of this case. And I thought I had to address it. I had to tell the jury, there's these things, let me see what I can do with this. And when I told the district court about Glover, Mr. Giacomo said, I'll object if he talks about those statements. I'm not sure I'm going to use the statements. Which was shocking to me. Especially, I don't need to say anymore, that's all he used in his rebuttal closing argument against me. They said, no, I'll object. So I then cite the court to Glover and say, I'd be committing misconduct if I say anything. I'm precluded, and it's one of the biggest portions of my opening argument. I'll object. I couldn't even talk about it.
What's your record cite for where that exchange between you and the court and Mr. Giacomo came? And you can look it up on while you're waiting.
Okay, I'll do that. It's cited in my brief where he says he's not sure, but he does say specifically, and I'll show you what
he said. Did you file a written motion in limine that would allow you to? Okay.
No, we were right about to do opening argument, and there was some discussion which I can't go off the record or outside of the record, but I asked the judge and then asked the state, would they object? I didn't want an objection in front of the jury.
It seems like the exchange here, though, Mr. Oram, results in your overreading Glover. The facts in Glover are quite a bit different. I acknowledge your concern about the subject matter, but there isn't a definitive statement by the state that they're going to use or not going to use. It's just they're unclear. In Glover, it was quite a bit different.
Yes, that's correct.
So it leads me to pose two questions. One, how is it different? And because of its difference, if you acknowledge it, should you have pursued it anyway and mentioned it in your opening statement? And secondly, is there some confusion that's been created by the jurisprudence in Glover?
I think it's a very interesting question.
I'm glad you think so.
If a prosecutor says he's going to object, and I've addressed it to the court, I have read this decision, the Glover decision, and to me it seems like we would commit misconduct. In other words, if the state's going to object, why don't we just do it outside the presence of the jury so I could find out? I most certainly don't want a district court judge in the start of a capital trial chastising me in front of the jury saying you're committing misconduct. That's going to look very poor. So I just did it outside the presence of the record. Obviously, there's differences here.
Once the prosecution equivocates, it seems like it's different than Glover.
Yes, but they were not unequivocal in the fact that they were going to object to me saying it. He said specifically, I will object if he talks about it. So that was very clear, and I have a cite for you. I cited it in my brief. He said, I'll object. So when I say to the court that I can't raise it, I don't say how I raise it. Then what happens through the entire trial, here are all these witnesses. You know, you have to remember, when they're listening to Mr. McCarty's statements, it almost takes 2 days. So we're just sitting there listening to Mr. McCarty ramble on in his way. And I haven't asked any questions of any witnesses about his statement. And you can imagine that there's a jury sitting over there looking over at defense counsel table thinking, you didn't even mention your client was out looking for instrumentalities of death. I haven't asked a single witness about it. I haven't addressed it with the jury. We're absolutely stuck on that issue. And it was, I would say, it was used as a goose. But I really just want to dovetail this with the fact that the statement shouldn't have come in the first place. And more importantly, when he said he would object, I really thought he wasn't going to bring him up because I thought he recognized that power was so strong and that the court had made error in admitting the statements and that he wouldn't use the statements. He was going to be, you know, crafty and not use the statements and not give me this type of issue for appeal.
What's your view of the Rothgary versus Gillespie County case, though, on the question of when the Sixth Amendment attaches with the prosecution's participation in this matter?
I would suggest that it attaches at the time. Well, I would say that power is controlled. For 8 hours, they have to bring him in. I think if the defendant is waiving his right to counsel, that they have the right to talk to him up until the time he's appointed an attorney. So I would say that counsel definitely attaches at the time he's supposed to be brought in front of a magistrate. So that would be my argument. And I don't really need anything more than that because here we have 13 days. So I would argue that counsel attaches at that time. It's when the judicial process begins.
So 48 hours after May 25th?
Well, he had waived his right to counsel originally, okay, when he was talking to the police.
Okay.
And could they go back? It really wasn't an issue that I had focused on a lot. If this had been more of an issue where we were dealing with a time period from the 25th to the 27th, I think I'd be more prepared to answer it.
I guess the thing I'm trying to understand is your explanation would address the statements on May 25th, but it still would make these statements on June 1st and 6th admissible.
No, because if it's May 25th, then 48 hours later, he would have had to...
But he waived on the 1st and the 6th. Don't those subsequent waivers apply?
No, because he would have had to be brought before a magistrate. This is an uneducated man who's essentially dealing with a detective through district attorney's office. No, within 48 hours, you bring him to a magistrate.
That's why I asked you about the Rothgary, if that's the correct pronunciation. Case, which had prosecutorial involvement prior to that too. That case seems to suggest that the attachment is later.
But I don't see how it could possibly be later because that would be an exception to power, which I don't think any court can do. I don't see how power, how does that in any way deviate or make an exception to power. Power says bring him before a magistrate in 48 hours. I don't see how any court can deviate from that. There's nothing I've read that said you can deviate from that. Am I understanding the question correctly?
Yes.
So if I have another issue I'd really like to focus on as well, and that is a Batson issue. In this case, Mr. McCarty was African-American. He was sentenced to death for and convicted of the murder of two non-African-American women. The jury was all non-African-American. Although they disputed in the answering brief, I then cite to the prosecutor below who said, yeah, they're all non-African-American. And there are two African-American jurors they exclude. And what I think is interesting is I'm going to focus for a second on Juror Brooks. She was a young female. She was a young, full-time college student at the University of Phoenix. She seemed like a very nice, well-spoken, presented very well young lady. And I have continuously argued in this court that the state is systematically removing black jurors. And one of the arguments that I have been presented with in some of my decisions is you can't prove it. There's no systematic proof. And I would cite this quote to Hawkins in 2011, and in my reply, I'll just read a portion that I'd like to address. This is a portion of an indented paragraph I have on page 24. Hawkins failed to show purposeful discrimination or pretext or to offer any analysis of any relevant considerations, such as comparative juror analysis or disparate questioning. Okay, here's what I have. When I make the Batson challenge on this young lady, they exclude the young lady. All they had at that point was she said, my brother had been arrested for, she thought, some traffic violation. He was treated fairly. I don't really have a strong relationship with my brother. I know nothing more. So I told her, but how is that? How is that a racially neutral reason? Like, that's just an excuse to get this young lady off. And then the prosecutor makes a horrendous mistake. He blurts out something that I would call almost like a firearm. He wishes he could take that bullet back. He desperately wishes he could take that bullet back. And that is, he said, he ran her scope. He went back to the office, ran her scope. And she had a license to at a strip joint, some kind of work card. He's running her scope. I would suggest that never has this court had any prosecutor say that they've run scopes on prospective jurors. I'm not sure, although I researched it, I could not find it. I don't think it's legal. I would argue, although I don't have the proof of it, isn't it abuse of power to be running scopes on prospective jurors? Women have done nothing. They can't even cite the facts. He's running scopes on a prospective juror. And so when I come back to Hawkins, and this court has said, show comparative juror analysis. Well, there it is. All those jurors, and what I can show is that the one juror, one of the jurors he wants to preempt, the young African-American female, he's run her scope. The second gentleman was Juror Rogers, who was a taxi driver. And all they had on him was he said he'd been the victim of some crime, but they made it clear. And not even a crime as serious as a burglary or a car theft. Nothing.
Well, before you leave Brooks, there was a male white juror who, or non-African-American, who similarly had a crime, a family member that had been either arrested or imprisoned. So the comparison between Brooks and the juror that was not excused, and I'm sorry I don't have his number, could you address that before you move on to the second?
Yes, I think that's a comparison that becomes obvious, that the reason that there's been an exclusion or pretextual exclusion of Juror Brooks is because she was African-American female. And it had nothing to do with her brother. How many people don't have a...
But wasn't there another juror that had a son that had been imprisoned?
Yes, I believe.
And did they run scope on him?
No, there's nothing in the record to suggest they ran scope on absolutely anybody. Now, I'm sure, and...
Well, they ran scope on two. They ran on Brooks and somebody named Decare, right?
I believe that's correct.
Okay.
But not on the other gentleman, and not throughout everybody. And I don't think it, like I said, I don't think it's even lawful. But it seems to me blatantly obvious why this is being done. And it's to exclude these jurors, exclude Juror Brooks, exclude Juror Rogers.
And so then if you want to traverse it as pretextual, how do you do that if you don't know whether there were other people with a strip card, a work card for a strip joint?
I would never have
gentleman's club.
I don't have the ability to run scope. I would never have that. Do you see? And so I just think it's just so disturbing. But isn't it disturbing that they picked her? If you read through her entire questions, there's nothing wrong with the lady. And so they can't give a reason. You see, they just don't want her on the jury. And they end up with an all non-African-American jury. And that, to me, is
in a death penalty case.
In any sense to death. And the co-defendant, who is much more culpable, had another prior murder and a rape. And he's not sentenced to death.
Mr. Long, too, I know it's almost coming on 10 minutes. I know I'm interested in the penalty phase. If you could address maybe the aggravated mitigator situation there and the issues that you brought before the court.
Yes, I'll briefly do that. One of great concern was they brought in a captain, a very respectable captain from the fire department. He's a relative of Ms. Combato. He said, give him the ultimate punishment. We had been objecting to the victim impact throughout the case. And when that happened, the court said that the district court said it was very unfortunate that had happened. The prosecution admitted that they had read a statement that he had prepared. And so it was sort of shocking to us that they're just blurting these things, they're blurting this out. We were also, the fact that we weren't able to say that Mr. Malone, who is an able-bodied man, whereas Mr. McCarty has cerebral palsy, and is seriously handicapped, that we're not able to bring out he has another murder and another rape, yet they can do it at Mr. Malone's trial. We can't bring out proportionality in a separate trial. The jury would have heard it. And so there are all sorts of concerns that I raise in the brief. Mm-hmm. I really would, if there are no more questions, like to have the rest
very
of the
time. Very well. You may do so. Mr. DiGiacomo. Mm-hmm. Focus on the issues that Mr. Long discussed, you know, like that, and
I will
certainly go into anything else you'd like to go into as well.
May it please the court, my name is Mark DiGiacomo. I'm a chief deputy district attorney and I represent the state of Nevada. I would like to start with something, and I don't mean to impugn Mr. Long, but when he cites the record, he cites to his statements in the record, not to the facts before the court. In his opening brief, he suggested to the court that there was some problem in the filing of the complaint 13 days after the arrest of Mr. McCarty. He never suggests in his brief that he was not brought before a magistrate. That is brought up in his reply, and hence why there's nothing in our briefing as it relates to the facts to that. Because if you go to page 145 of volume 1 of the record on appeal, Mr. McCarty was booked late night on the 25th, early morning on the 26th, and had a probable cause review on 5/27/06 by Judge Justice Rodney Burke. Then on May 30th of 2006, he's brought before the court, and I believe the reason that there's an extra day in there is because of the Memorial Day holiday. He is brought before the court, he is arraigned before the magistrate, and the DA requests 5 additional days to file a criminal complaint, something that happens in justice court every day down here. And it was and during that time period, he's handed a piece of paper in which his advice, which is signed off by Justice Rodney Burr, in which he is advised of his rights under the Miranda decisions and his right to counsel. It's subsequent to that court hearing in justice court where he has been brought before a magistrate and he has been provided his rights and bail has been set for the defendant, that the defendant has his father contact the DA's office saying the defendant wants to talk to you. And then the police officers, who had no indication or no desire to go down there and talk to Mr. McCarty, went down there and talked to him.
So he initiated the request for the...
He actually initiated the request subsequent to seeing a magistrate. So Powell and all of the cases that Mr. Orem is suggesting to you that this is some sort of enemy combatant situation is completely inapplicable to the situation. He saw a magistrate as required by the Constitution, and subsequent to seeing that magistrate, requested to speak to the police, who, when they go in the room, read him his Miranda warnings again. And Mr. McCarty even says to him, well, you can't help me. He goes, you're right. The only thing I can do is tell the DA what you told me, but anything you say can be used against you.
Let me just clarify. When he was put in handcuffs, I guess, behind the 7-Eleven on the 25th, I believe.
Right, I'm going to back up to that one second.
When was he Mirandized the first time?
Yes. Once again, this was Mr. Orange referring to what he said in the record as opposed to what the evidence was. The evidence is that Detective Whitings, who is not the person who wrote the affidavit on May 23rd, was aware that Mr. McCarty was a person of interest. And as the court's aware from reading these briefs, there's three people in this case, three potential suspects. There's Mr. Herb, there's Mr. McCarty, and there's Mr. Malone. After finding Mr. Herb, they learn that Mr. McCarty is on foot down the street. Detective Whitings goes down there, contacts Mr. McCarty. Mr. McCarty goes, "Oh, thank God, there's people out here who are trying to hurt me. I'm glad you're the police. I want to talk to you." Detective Whitings says to Mr. McCarty, "Well, look, I'm not the detective on this case. Detective Collins is the detective on this case. He'd like to talk to you. Do you mind waiting around while Detective Collins drives from Henderson to the 7-Eleven, which is up on kind of the northeast side of town?" And Mr. McCarty says, "Sure." Detective Whitings says, "Hey, can I buy you a water, a soda, a cigarette, something like that?" McCarty goes, "Great." And they go into the 7-Eleven together, they buy some cigarettes, they buy some soda, they go and sit on the tailgate of Detective Whitings' truck, where you drop the tailgate. They sat there and waited for Detective Collins to show up. Detective Collins showed up, said, "Will you talk to me?" And there's a long conversation that they have. And at page 136, Mr. McCarty, this is the only actual fact citing in Mr. Orme's brief, says something in effect of, "Hey, can you and I take a walk?" And Detective Collins says, "No, we can't take a walk away from the reporter. Why do you want to talk to me off tape?" McCarty says, "Well, I don't really want to talk to you off tape. You know, let's walk over here." And at that point, Detective Collins says, "No, you know what? Turn around, handcuffs on, reads him his Miranda warnings," and that's at page 142. And subsequent to that reading of the Miranda warnings, McCarty still wants to speak, and they speak for about 25 more pages, and ultimately, at the end of that conversation is when he's taken to the Henderson Detention Center. So there's nothing about before the handcuffs went on that would indicate at all that this is a custodial situation whatsoever with Mr. McCarty. And the suggestion that he was the only possible suspect dovetails into the three statements in particular, because what we have is you have Mr. Malone, who basically says, "I don't know anything about anything." You have Mr. McCarty, who says, "Mr. Malone and Mr. Herb did it, and I was at Mr. McCarty's house, or Mr. Herb's house." And you have Mr. Herb saying, "No, Malone and McCarty did it, and I was at home." And that was the problem from this case, is it was clear that there was two suspects that were present out in that desert who committed the homicide, but there was three potential suspects, which is why the criminal complaint, there needed to be an additional 5 days, because there was a request for phone records. When those phone records came in, the phone records clearly established that Mr. Herb was at his house, Mr. McCarty was at the desert hitting off a cell tower right next to the two bodies, for about an hour before Mr. Herb leaves his house, or his phone does, and drives down to the area where the crimes occurred and helps dispose of the weapons. At that point, the criminal complaint is filed on the next court date that the judge set, charging Mr. Malone and Mr. McCarty in the homicides, and Mr. Herb as an accessory after the fact, as the evidence bore out it would. And it turns out that that was indisputable by the time we got to trial, because there was a video at a gas station. Mr. Herb says, "When I get the phone call from Mr. McCarty, I get in my car, the white car, and I'm driving down to go to the desert, but I'm out of gas. So I stopped to get gas." And the police were able to recover at 1:15 or 1:20 in the morning after homicides, or during the time period the homicides were occurring, some 25 miles away from the scene where the homicides are occurring, Mr. Herb on video with the white car buying the gas. And so we had the variety of statements of Mr. McCarty, which Mr. Orme has kind of suggested to you there are a number of lies. Well, that's correct. The one thing he maintains throughout is Mr. Malone and Mr. Herb committed the crime, and I was the accessory after the fact. And that, as far as the state was concerned, when we stood up for opening statements, was the only issue in the case. And the defense was aware of that. Mr. Malone comes up to me and says, "Hey, are you going to play Mr. McCarty's statement?" And my response to him is, "Well, depends on what it is you do. I mean, if the only issue in this case is, yeah, is it Mr. Herb or Mr. McCarty that's at Mr. Herb's house at the time the homicides are occurring? No, there's no way I'm going to play these statements. If, however, we're going to be fighting over the 72-hour timeline that is this case, then we very well may be playing those statements. Because Mr. McCarty acknowledges what every other witness says about the intervening 3 days. The only thing that they really dispute is who's the person who's at Mr. Hurd's house and who's the person who's out in the desert at the time of the homicide. Mr. Orm and Mr. Sproul then decide to make some sort of record where they go, well, the state says they may not play it, so I think I can't say it in opening. And the court asked me, Mr. Jekyll, are you going to talk about the statements in opening? And I said, no, I'm not talking about the statements in opening. As far as I'm concerned, they're self-serving statements of the defendant. And as far as I know, the only issue in this case is who's at that house. And I can establish from the phone records and the video who's at that house, so it's not an issue for us. There is a discussion which Mr. Orm says the state definitely said they'd object. No, what I said was, depending on what Mr. Orm says, we may or may not object. It depends on if it's objectionable or not. There is a way for him to tell the story of what the evidence will show without saying, my client gave 5 separate statements on 3 separate days in which he said this one in this statement and that one in that statement and this one in that statement, because none of us know how many of those statements are going to come in. The defense then chose a strategy, and I'm not going to at all suggest to you that two of the best capital defense lawyers chose a bad strategy in this case, because they didn't. They were kind of hamstrung with, if we just put on the defense that Herb's not at the house but out at the desert, but McCarty's at the house, well, the cell phone records in that videotape destroy us. And so it's going to be a very quick verdict for this jury if that's our only defense. So what do? They make a strategic decision. I mean, these are two heavyweight capital defense litigators who make a strategic decision. We're going to dispute every fact that every witness says about the intervening 72 hours. And so now they're 4 weeks later into trial, and they've crossed well on maybe she has Mr. McCarty's phone, although they know that Mr. McCarty acknowledges in his first statement that he's had the phone all along and nobody else at any time during the relevant time periods had his phone. They dispute who's in possession of which car when, despite the fact that Mr. McCarty, in his second statement, discusses being in possession of the green Aurora, which is the motor vehicle in this particular case at that point in time. They dispute with Ms. Asturias about going to the Oasis on 2 days before the homicide with Christine Cabado and looking for Victoria McGee. They go through and they go after every witness on every little fact that their client has already acknowledged is true. And so at the end of the day, Mr. Lawley and I are in a position like, well, what do we want to do? Do we want to put the defendant's self-serving statements in where he presents the defense that is the only viable defense, which is Mr. Herb's the one who did it, and he wasn't, and corroborate all our other witnesses, or do we, on the other side, leave those out and argue the credibility of the witnesses? And at that point, Mr. Lawley and I made a strategic decision that those statements should be played. And there was nothing inadmissible about those statements. Despite Mr. Orm's rendition of the facts, this was fully litigated before the court in front of Judge Glass, and we litigated again in front of Judge Milano, and both of them made the same factual finding. He wasn't in custody on May 25th until the cuffs went on and his Mirandas were read, and he voluntarily waived them. And he's the one who initiated the contact with the police after he saw the magistrate, and that he was read his Miranda warnings and voluntarily waived them. There isn't a factual scenario that would suggest that there was anything improper about any of those statements, the manner in which they were played, or the facts that we used them. And Mr. Orland's suggestion that somehow my rebuttal argument evinces that I was lying to the court, I was going to use them all along. No, my rebuttal argument was in response to their closing argument, which is they continued after playing the statements to argue to the jury the facts that his client acknowledged in the statements were true. And so in the evening between the defense's closing and my rebuttal, I went through and pulled out little snippets of every one of those facts that they claimed in their closing were untrue and played for the jury those facts. It was in direct response to their rebuttal, and we had no way of knowing, standing there when they're asking us if we're playing the statement or not, whether or not we were intended to play the statements. And so the statements are a non-issue. In addition to that, the other issue that brought up, and the court said something, and I just briefly flipped through, it was Justice Pickering who said that, because I pulled all of the jury questionnaires in this case in order to prepare for this argument. And I went through the questionnaires just quickly now because I didn't see when I was preparing these that there was someone who said their son had gone to prison.
It was a father.
There was three jurors that were on the panel as it was concluded, and I have each and every one of those in front of me. Let's start with Mr. Brooks. Ms. Brooks. Let's start with Mr. Rogers because he's absolutely the most simplest of the batching challenge. First of all, at page 5954 of the record, pre-use of the preemptory challenges, there were four or five African-American jurors that were inside the panel. That's four or five of 36.
Was there a record made of the veneer of how many African-Americans were in the veneer?
The total veneer?
Yeah.
I didn't go back and look because that wasn't directly raised in the appeal. So I haven't gone back and looked to see if that record was made. But at page 5954, there's a discussion before preempts even start that there's four or five African-Americans. And it's not like each juror was asked, are you African-American or not? But that was the conversation. And the defense does not dispute the fact that there is four or five African-Americans in that panel. The defense struck one on their own.
Why do you take a chance on a capital murder case of excluding black jurors? Why would you take a chance knowing it's structural error if we find that you committed error? Why would you take a chance?
Aren't you trying to defend these Batson charges in front of this court? Knocking off black juror after black juror after black juror and then coming up with race-neutral reasons?
I will, as respectfully as I can, I don't necessarily practice law under the position that I should do something that is totally not inappropriate in order to protect a record because the court seems to be focusing on the Batson challenge. When you look at 36 jurors, I have 10 preempts, they have 10 preempts, and your panel is now, it's 36 people in a panel. So if I use 10 preempts, by definition, one of them is going to have to be African-American. There's no other choice in that matter, just from a statistical probability here. It's not like the old days where you have 12 jurors, one person is preempted, and then you have to decide, do I want to fill that person in from the back of the row? I know that all 36 jurors have to say, and I know which one of those jurors is going to be good for the state versus bad for the state. And I make an analysis of these 10 jurors, or of these 10 challenges, of these 36, which are the worst 10 jurors for the state? And I don't look at race. The only person that's in the courtrooms that are looking at race is the defense and the judge because they're required to. From the state of Nevada,
you're required to. That's what Batson's all about.
Batson says I am not supposed to be considering race, Your Honor, when I make a decision to challenge a juror. So when I look at Mr. Rogers, for example, who is the only juror out of 200 who refused to answer practically a single question in his questionnaire, and on questioning by the state will not affirmatively represent one way or the other about anything that he stood for, whether or not he had any memory whatsoever of the crimes that he acknowledged that he was, and he, on the questionnaire, and it was, it's page 4 of the questionnaire, of every questionnaire, there's a series of questions as it relates to the death penalty. Every juror filled out that questionnaire, except for Mr. Rogers, who writes in there that, and I will quote Mr. Rogers, said, maybe this is a part of my record, do you believe in the death penalty? Undecided. One. And then the next question, how would you best describe it? It's not the choice. You just have to check off a box here, Mr. Rogers. He writes his own line in. I can't relate to any of these statements. Then he goes back and answers a different question about which penalty you think is the worst, and he checks off two, and he says, I can't choose between the two of those. And so when I'm questioning this person, the suggestion from the court is I should leave an African-American on my jury because he's African-American, as opposed to striking a juror who's clearly not qualified to sit on this jury because he is going to be a problem for the state. So I have to decide, do I decide his race matters?
Why is he a problem for the state?
Because that's an individual who is clearly identified to me and is unwilling to commit to following the rules of evidence and being somebody who is unwilling to acknowledge to me that he believes in the system of punishment. As this court, particularly Justice Sherry, you know, The death penalty is an issue for jurors in which it raises strong opinions one way or the other. You have tons of them who say, if I convict the guy, it's only going to be death. And you have tons of them that says, if I don't convict the person, or if I convict somebody, there's no way I'm going to consider the death penalty. And those people who are willing to acknowledge that are removed. The suggestion from the court is I should leave Mr. Rogers not knowing the answer as to whether or not that he really believes that the system of justice in Nevada should have one of the punishment that the courts apply in a case. And the suggestion to me that I should leave someone because he's black is much like when the defense attorney suggests to a court, judge, everybody else I'd like to want here that's Caucasian for cause, this guy I'm not going to agree that his challenge for cause should be granted because he's African-American. The suggestion is that we should choose race in order to discriminate against them. It may be discrimination in favor of the defendant, but it's still discrimination. In my mind, the suggestion is, look at these 36 people. Tell me which one of these 36 people, or 14 that remained, was a better juror than Mr. Rogers, and the answer is none. And such as that, I struck him because none of the other jurors were better.
And McCarty was African-American?
He was.
And both the counsel for the McCarty were Caucasian?
That's correct.
And both DAs were Caucasian?
That's correct.
And the judge was Caucasian?
Yes, I was.
And McCarty sat alone as the lone African-American facing the death penalty.
I would disagree with that. Mr. Ferguson, who wound up being an alternate, was African-American.
Did he deliberate with the jury?
He did not deliberate with the jury, and that's what when Mr. Orham says this deliberating jury, it has no African Americans on it. That's at the end of penalty phase after two jurors have been removed for cause, and I don't know if they're African American or not. But there was at least one, if not two, African Americans that wound up in the final 14 that were sitting in front of the panel. It's not until ultimately, after a very long trial, several jurors were removed, and the final 12 that went back for penalty were placed in the back room, that Mr. Orham says, I just want the record to reflect that in the deliberating jury on this penalty phase, there is no African Americans. And as far as I know, that statement is in fact true, but legally is not relevant. And moving on to Ms. Brooks, unlike the person who says they had a bad check case dismissed, that was one person who said there had been arrest, there was another person who indicated that there was an uncle who had a reckless driving that wound up on this panel conviction from some period of time ago. And then there was a third individual who says, I have a nephew who I'm not really sure. He's been in and out of prison a number of times. And if you can go through, you can go through the rest of jury selection. Those are the sitting jurors. Of the rest of the jury selection, that question was answered a number of times by a number of individuals. And the rehabilitation and the questions asked for that juror were always the same.
So those three Caucasian jurors served on this jury?
When you say Caucasian jurors, I would disagree with the court that there is any suggestion or any indication necessary that they're Caucasian. To say that they were not African American, and I know the court hasn't been in bringing in panels. The panels that come through now, to call them Caucasian, you can say they were not African American, but Asian, Hispanic, Indian,
Mr. Bell, Giacomo was there a record made of the individuals? Or is this your recollection you're giving us at this point?
Oh, no, there's a very long record made, and then there's a...
Of the individuals.
U.S. 59-54.
Walk us through Mrs. Brooks and talk about your rationale for using Batson, also your explanation about the equal protection issue that was raised by Mr. Orham.
Absolutely. So when Ms. Brooks's comes up, Mr. Orham asks her a series of questions. At one point, he asks her a question, and she starts crying, and he tells her, I don't mean to pry. Let me move on, and he moves away. And we still don't know what the answer to that question was, and I'm not clear from the record what exactly he was asking her, but there's a discussion at page 252 of when the Batson challenges were, or when the argument on the Batson challenges occur, in which we discussed that, and the court notes, yes, I remember heard that happening. I got up and started asking her questions about her brother that she lived with, who said, I lived with my brother at the time. He got caught on a traffic ticket and then went to prison for 3 years. Okay, well, look, are we talking about fraud, forgery, are we talking about shooting, guns, violence? I don't know. I don't have it. Well, you were with him. Do you still have contact with your brother today?
He's 12 or 13 at the time, correct?
She was 13. He was 18 or 19. Well, you still know him today, and you're telling us that you don't know anything about whatsoever about your brother. No, I have no memory whatsoever. I don't know what my brother went to prison for. Yeah, I still have contact with him, but I have no idea. So now the state's faced with, okay, here's a situation where, as opposed to every other juror who is able to at least describe or at the very least acknowledge that from what the circumstances they knew, that this was, that they had no animus towards the state of Nevada, and clearly the Clark County District Attorney's Office prosecuted her. Her brother. We went back and we said to ourselves, or I can tell you that I said to myself, well, I want to know what it is that Ms. Brooks' brother does before I make my challenges. And so I started researching Ms. Brooks, and there's been some sort of suggestion that when the state of Nevada uses databases available to it, that there's some rule, there's some law.
Mr. Giacomo, it's not as those databases that the concern is. The concern is the scope of NCIC.
Correct. There was no indication that NCIC was used, but I have still not seen, it's not in the briefs anywhere, I've seen the argument 10 years ago.
Well, that's why I asked you to respond as to that, and why it should or should not be allowed. And I understand 10 years ago, but we're not 10 years ago.
Well, there is no rule that precludes a prosecutor from utilizing scope in that manner. I am aware, and as I'm sure...
Is that available to private counsel?
Upon request of the court, it is. And Judge Villani said that. Had you requested me, counsel, to run scope on any particular juror, I would have run it for you, or I would have asked the state to run it for you.
You said that after the fact, correct?
Correct.
Did you say that before the jury was impaneled? Did he say that before the jury selection began?
He didn't say that before the jury selection began. He said that when he said... Because Mr. Strozen said, well, I used to ask, and the judges would say no. And Judge Blank said, well, you never asked me, and had you asked me, had you had a reason that you needed it, I would have considered it. Scope is not precluded. The state is not precluded from running scope. I'm sure Justice Hardison...
No, 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 but this is a situation, we're talking about a murder case, we're not talking about just a petty larceny case.
Sure.
You talked about this individual juror and you said animus toward the state. The question is whether they can be fair and impartial as to the charges before the court. Whether they would look at this case and there's a murder and whether they were willing to make a fair representation. That is the question before us. And I guess there's a concern because at the end of the day, you are going to be asking, or you ask the jury, to say, we wish to have this person put to death for their violation.
Yes.
So the question is, do we or do we not have a fair trial? Not just the process, but a fair trial. So that's the question. Should we look to change the policy that says in all cases, defense counsel will have access to scope or NCIC to be on equal footing with the DA's office? Should we in fact consider that?
I would suggest to the court that that would be some sort of legislation that that could occur, I guess, from a legislative standpoint.
Could the court not do it under the Constitution?
I don't know that there was never briefed about access to information. I don't know that there's any constitutional rule upon which we're relying upon. I mean, I take the court's position, or Justice Douglas's position, to be something to the effect of we want a system in which the defense has the same access to the information.
The question is fair and impartial, that level playing field I keep hearing about. Mr. Giacomo, another theory to you is that, as to Ms. Brooks, the statement, someone, the state of Nevada is not going to need somebody who works at a strip club on their panel. That was supposedly gleaned by this work card that simply seemed to say the person was a seller of alcohol beverages. She had a work card, which meant she was an individual of sufficient standing to get a work card in the state of Nevada.
Well,
when we are a liquor and gaming state.
What the work card actually said was, when we ran it, she had recently received a work card.
Yes.
We filled out as of her employment as full-time student and no mention of that. She recently received a work card in which she indicated that she worked at an adult, or that the work card indicated she was authorized to work.
Is that in the legal business, sir?
Certainly it is not, but we're not talking
about that. Did you ask her one question about that? That's disturbing, that as I read your voir dire of this jury, you did not ask Ms. Brooks a single question about working for an adult club.
We were precluded, Justice Pickering, by the facts and circumstances as they arose.
Because you didn't look up until you knew you were going to excuse her work card.
No, I didn't look up her work card. What happened?
You didn't look up on Scope until you knew you were going to recuse her. That's the way I read this.
That's simply untrue.
Okay, then tell me why, because that's very disturbing.
What happens is Ms. Brooks provides very limited information about her brother. And so I go looking, and this is all on the record, I go looking in Odyssey and our C-Track system to see if I can find the case that involves her brother. And it comes to my attention.
But you didn't just ask her what was your maiden name?
It didn't strike me until I couldn't find her brother that I needed to do that. So I went looking for her maiden name. I went to marriage licenses, and this is all on the record.
Did you do that before or after you examined her?
After I examined her, she couldn't answer the questions related to her brother. Now I want to know the answer. Like, why is it that this individual has not provided me the information that I need to glean? And from there, we ran a scope, which is not the only jury we ran a scope on. We ran the scope for her. It came up that she had a work card that was not referenced in her employment in her application for her in her questionnaire. She had refused to answer a question from Mr. Orm. And when I'm looking at 36 jurors, or we're looking at 36 jurors, I have 10 preempts. I know they're going to utilize some of their preempts. I'm going to use some of my preempts. And the decision at that point is, do I leave her not knowing the answer, or do I strike her? And the suggestion that I should consider that if she had been white, she'd been gone no question of the day. But because she's African American, the decision should change for me is something that I just do not believe is true.
Fair enough. What about Ms. DeCare? Was she left on the jury or not?
She was. She had no scope record whatsoever when they ran.
But she did have a relative who was...
Mr. Carroll was an
incarcerated, correct?
I did not see that, but I have Mr. Carroll here right now, and if the court would give me just a
second. Can I answer, has anyone close to you ever been charged with, arrested for, or convicted of criminal offense? My real father, but
I don't know exactly. He passed away almost 3 years ago, though.
And she's the other one you ran the scope on. Why did you run the scope on her? What does the record show about that?
It was in response to the way she looked and presented. I thought that she might be someone who worked at an adult establishment.
Yeah, I get that it's very hard with peremptory challenges versus challenges for cause, but in this area...
Yes,
it's genuinely disturbing, and it really is.
And I guess that the disturbance from the court and the frustration from the state is that the court is under the assumption that when we utilize a peremptory challenge against an African-American, the reason must be because they're African-American. And what I'm telling you is that when you look at this record and you look at all 36 questionnaires that were before you, and you picked out the 10 the state would kick and you pick out the 10 the defense would kick, you could very easily do it. And in these questionnaires, you have no idea what their race is. You could easily look through them and go, these people will stay, these people will go, and without consideration of the race, and which is what prosecutors are supposed to be doing. And the frustration from us is when the court says to us, well, why did you do it when she was African American? Well, to me, that's not what we're supposed to be doing.
We understand that, but when we look at the record, the cold record, and we see one juror, the one you struck, and the other one who has something similar, and you said you were uncomfortable with that answer, we have a like answer, you couldn't get any background, you didn't strike that person. What do you think? Should we not inquire?
You should go to her questions and her answers and compare the questions and answers at voir dire as
to... We did, and I just listened to you, and you said you wrote a second scope because you had an issue as to answers you received or did not receive, but you chose, your prerogative, not to strike this one whose answers were similar. The one you got full disclosure, the other one, you should have still had a big question mark. You didn't strike. It's a query, so you're asking for explanation. Yeah. The other, though, as I said, we have clear Batson, but we also have, as I said, that equal protection, that equalness. And again, they not having this same access that you do, and in this case, you indicate, in some cases, you said, well, you run everybody. In this case, you said, we only ran it twice.
It was Washer runs everybody. County, we...
Well, you said quite a few things, but you also indicated in some cases you do it.
And so the court's aware, I ran scope on two jurors. One juror, it was identified for me that she had, she worked at a strip club. And the other juror, my question was, did she work at a strip club? I ran a scope. She didn't have a scope, meaning she didn't have a work card, which indicated to me she didn't work at a strip club. And therefore, my question was...
Work cards limited to strip clubs, Mr. Giacomo.
No, but that question I was trying to figure out was, is she a stripper?
Mr. John, I know that.
You were trying to figure out if Brooks was a stripper?
No, well, I was Ms. DeCare. I was looking to find out whether or not Ms. DeCare worked at an adult nightclub. That's what the reason for running this scope was.
Okay. Mr. John, I know we have a whole bunch of questions here today. Why don't you take 2 minutes, sum up your position here, and I'll give Mr. Orr additional time to offset that as well.
Just briefly, as it relates to, there's one issue that you raised as related to penalties. Mr. Orr suggests that there should have been a mini trial that relates to Mr. Malone's. Now, I know there's flying in out there, flying in the co-defendant's sentences are admissible. Mr. Malone hadn't been sentenced yet. What they wanted to do was litigate that evidence, and certainly I don't think the court wants to devolve a penalty hearing into litigation as to whether or not it's appropriate for that penalty. As I would relate to the Batson challenge, not only would this court have to find that the state's reasons for striking the jury were pretextual, but you would have to also say it was an abuse of discretion for Judge Villani, who sat through the questioning, saw every one of those jurors, made a complete record, as you've told him to do, as to what he was thinking and why it is he didn't believe it was or was not pretextual. And I think to a certain extent, on appellate review, this court has on a number of occasions taken the courts to task for not doing exactly what Judge Villani did. This argument that we're having about the facts that I'm having with the various judges that are sitting before me right now is the exact same argument I had in front of Judge Villani, who had a substantial more information than the cold record reflects, who made no finding that there was any indication of what we did had any racial bias whatsoever. It's the presumption that I think comes from the appellate courts that the state is engaging in some sort of discrimination, and that is what has caused both myself, Mr. Lawley, and those of us in the office to be frustrated by the fact that there isn't anything related to racial prejudice that is going on during the course of our selection. What we are doing is trying to identify the best jurors for us, and we have a system in which we know the defined number of jurors, 36, and we choose our best 10 out of that 36, and from there, that's where we wind up. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Tracy, would you give Mr. Warren 3 additional minutes?
Do I have that? The 10 best jurors that he's going to get rid of, we know what they are. The frustration I hear today is exactly the frustration I felt when I was sitting down in that lower court. And in the end, when I hear Mr. Giacomo, by the way, I see my colleague who I've done many trials with is just a brilliant orator, somebody who can answer questions and get himself out of issues better than anybody. He is just so good at it. And what I noticed in the last half hour, when there was so much discussion by Mr. Giacomo, things that aren't in the record at all, there what he thought back at the office, it's against the rules of appellate procedure. Cite it to the record. And It is highly disturbing what's happening. It was highly disturbing at the moment in time when we found out he'd run the scope. Okay? That lady, Ms. Brooks, was just fine. There was nothing wrong with her. And Justice Douglas, one thing, it was not on this case, another case before this court, but I went back and actually read Batson. I think sometimes we just cite to traditional stuff, and I actually read the decision. And one thing I thought was so interesting in Batson is the United States Supreme Court discussing, it's not just the right of Mr. McCarty, the right of the court, the right of the state. It's the right of the juror. The juror has that equal protection right to sit. And one thing that was interesting, because I guess I had lost sight of what it was, it's that if we exclude people based upon race, then what it does is it diminishes society's belief in our system of justice. If somebody is excluded because of the color of their skin, then they no longer believe in our system of justice. And that's what the United States Supreme Court said. And that's what's apparent here. I wrote it in my brief, and I debated whether I'd say it. I said in the brief, I'm not accusing Mr. DiGiacomo being racist at all. Not at all. What I'm saying is that he's a good, good trial attorney who knows who would be really good on these juries. And he knows that if you get rid of certain jurors, you got a good chance of a death sentence. And unfortunately, those jurors are oftentimes black. And that's why I got rid of them. That's why we sat with an all-non-African-American deliberating jury. And that's why he went and got a scope when he couldn't get rid of Ms. Brooks. And so I cited extensively because I was concerned that he would say these things about Ms. Brooks to what she said. And I'm citing on page 41 of my opening brief, and there's cites to the record on all of this from her testimony, from her statement. Ms. Brooks informed the prosecutor she was a full-time student. Ms. Brooks indicated that her brother had been arrested on charges, but she was unaware of the nature of the charges. Ms. Brooks then clarified that her brother had been stopped for speeding, and she believed he had been incarcerated. As was pointed out, she was a kid. Ms. Brooks explained that she had a limited relationship with her brother. That's why she doesn't know, because her brother is probably gone off. And on page 42, Ms. Brooks indicated the system had treated her brother fairly. So here was a lady who made it very clear to Mr. Giacomo, something with my brother, you know, I'm telling you he was incarcerated or something, he was treated fairly, I don't really know much about my brother. And from this, he's got to go run her scope, and he doesn't tell us any of this stuff. It's when I say it's not race neutral, it's not a race neutral reason, there's another reason, and all of a sudden he blurts it out. Like I said, I thought it was, as soon as he said it, he regretted it. As soon as he said it, that gentleman regretted saying that, because he knew it was going to come up here. Why is he running a scope? And when I look at Mr. Rogers, the way he makes Mr. Rogers sound, he makes him sound so poor. Mr. Rogers was very clear, and I'm actually quoting Mr. Rogers. Mr. Rogers was asked by the prosecution if he'd been the victim of a crime, such as his house being broken into or his car stolen. He indicated, in quotes, nothing major like that. What was the problem with these jurors? Well, I can tell you what the problem was. The problem is they don't make good jurors for the state of Nevada. And in the end, de facto, it's discrimination. Not because I don't think that Mr. Giacomo likes to see people of color on a jury. It's not what I'm saying. I'm saying that they are much less likely to return a sentence of death. And that is the problem. I heard Mr. DiGiacomo say that I struck a black juror. I did.
And I Mr. Owen,
excuse me, you did or didn't?
I did.
You did, okay.
And I'd like to explain it, but
defense as well as the state has a right to strike for cause and to preempt jurors. If we determined after looking at everything it was not a Batson violation, should we take into consideration equal protection? You and Mr. Scray were represented to Judge Villani that you felt there was a equal protection argument that could be made, but yet the record is really not clear in terms of the argument that was made before Judge Villani asked of that. What do you say?
Yes, I think it was gross out there. We can't run scope. You asked, I think it was you, Justice Douglas, who asked, do you have access to it? I don't have access to scope. If you asked me to run Joe Blow spoke right now, I can't do it. I can't do it in my office. I have no access to it. And I know I shouldn't go outside the record. There's a case coming up where a man's received death while I've traveled against Mr. DiGiacomo. I asked Judge Ellsworth, make them give us scopes. And she told me, they're not allowed to give you scopes. It's illegal. They're not allowed to run scopes on the people. And I thought, oh boy, isn't that interesting. Okay? Isn't that interesting? I can't figure that out. They have access to things that I could never have access to.
Mm-hmm. Tell us why you struck the one African-American juror.
He's perfect for my argument. They called a man a career military guy. Okay? Career military man. African-American. Okay? Wonderful character. Because I think we should strike people on the content of their character, whether they're good or not. He had a wonderful character, serving our country. I looked at him and thought, oh, that man will return the sentence of death easily. So I struck him. It didn't matter if he was white, black, Asian, Hispanic. Military guys from Nellis, if I'm teaching a young defense lawyer, I'm like, you don't want them on the jury. They're going to be very tough on a defendant. Okay? So I struck him. I struck him for the content of his character as a military man. That's a complete opposite of what he did. Did Justice Perry-Gary, did he strike Ms. Brooks because she was a young student? No. He struck her because of the color of her skin. I would strike any military man, unless they were a Vietnam combat veteran. However, he struck her because she was a young student.
Cut against your argument that these jurors have a right to serve.
No, not at all. I have a right to kick somebody because of what they say.
In the military,
it's not a protected class under Batson. Mm-hmm. It's not a protected class. And as I stated, if you bring me a Vietnam vet, I remember when Justice Douglas was a district court judge, one of the four people on a case I tried in front of him was a military, a Vietnam vet. I believe Vietnam vets were a little more skeptical of
our... My question to follow up on Justice Perry-Gary is Mr. DiGiacomo was saying he's concerned about people who work in the adult businesses, or I'm not sure exactly what certain types of adult businesses. You're concerned about people who have been in the military. Isn't this trial strategy where perhaps his argument was that it wasn't race, it was other reasons he was exercising his strikes, like you did for this particular juror? What's your response to that?
Reason. He didn't know if she was in the adult industry at all. At the time he ran her scope, she was a full-time student. He didn't run her scope because she's black. The difference. The man said he was a military man. I could see him. I could hear him. I could see his attention to duty. There was nothing left to say. This lady was a kind lady. I remember specifically. I'm a student. Lady runs her scope. I'm going to strike people based on what I think is bad, based on the content of their character, not because they're black or white, not because they're black or white or Hispanic, but on the content of their character.
But he also ran Mr. Kersko.
Yes. That's true. Now I cannot answer why he did that. I can't get in his head. There's nothing really in the record, too much in the record to explain that. But why Ms. Brooks? Mm-hmm. Why Ms. Brooks? What had she done? If you go back and read Ms. Brooks, what had she done other than she was black?
What did Ms. LeCare do? Other than she was Caucasian?
No. Justice Perry-Gary. We weren't filled with an all-African-American jury. We had none. We had none. He had a reason for why he wanted to do that with the Caucasian woman. I disagree that he should be allowed to do that in the first place. But now what you're doing is you're limiting the fact that he went right at the two potential African-Americans that we could have that could sit there. It's equal protection. They had a right to sit there. Why is he running her scope? It doesn't make any sense. It makes no sense.
Mr. Warren, my understanding is from the representation of counsel that before preempts were exercised, there were 4 to 5 African-American members of the panel, correct? In the 36.
I heard him say that right now. I don't independently recall that, and I don't see where there is.
He gave us a record site, so I'll consult the record site, but you don't recall.
When I say that...
And is it also the truth that there were 2 African-Americans on the 14. They ended up being alternates, but they were on the 14.
Again,
is that true?
I do not independently recall that.
Okay, we'll consult the record on that, too.
Yes.
But your statement a moment ago, definitively, is that there were no African-Americans. And your statement really is there were no African-Americans left deliberating. That's your argument.
When you make that distinction, yes. What you're saying is...
You're not making the distinction. You're using it pretty broadly, I would say.
Well, let me make that distinction so that it's clear. Because when you asked me about the alternates, as I heard Mr. Giacomo say it, I thought about it, but my memory, having done so many trials, I cannot remember. But if we had video, which we do, if there were two, and you said, Mr. Orme, you said it, and you were incorrect, I would want to apologize. I don't independently remember.
Just asking you to contrast what his representations were here.
I just have no memory of that. What I remember was bitterly complaining that we had an all non-African-American deliberating jury, so that there's clarification. And I disputed the fact that they should be able to use scope, that they should be able to do these things.
I'd like you to clarify this question about the use of scope. When the subject matter of scope came up, did you make a request of the district court to see the scope that prosecution consulted?
It was Mr. Scrove who I believe objected, my co-counsel. And
was a request made to consult the scope consulted by the prosecution?
I don't recall, as I stand.
Mr. Giacomo represents to the court today that Judge Villani indicated, after the selection had been made, that had a request been made for scope, it would have been provided. Do you have a recollection of that?
No, but the record was extraordinarily long, and if it's in the record, I'm not going to say anything about it.
All right. Thanks.
Did you find the record site for where you raised the Glover issue before trial?
Very briefly. What I'm saying to is my appellate appendix, volume 35, page
7. I'm sorry, could you speak up? I didn't hear you.
I'm sorry. I'm citing to appellate appendix, volume 35, page 7686. And this is what I have in here. I cite to this on page 38 of my opening brief. Prior to the introduction of Mr. McCarty's statement, defense counsel complained that the state had admitted they would object if defense counsel had mentioned Mr. McCarty's statement during opening argument. That is what I have to find.
And then the second question I have is Mr. DiGiacomo contested what you said with respect to the Powell issue and when this defendant was brought before a magistrate. I'd like to hear your comment on that.
What I would say to that is, again, these are things that Mr. Giacomo says in front of the court. He cited to a portion. It's interesting.
But he's saying the same thing of you, so.
Right, except for what I'm saying is in the state's brief, there's no mention of this. And I was raising Hamadi in my opening brief, saying, how can you keep him in there without a lawyer? And they don't ever raise anything. They never cite it.
Mr. Orme, it's a simple question. Was your client arraigned on May 27th at the Anderson Justice Court? Yes or no?
Justice Harvesty, without looking at that part of the record, I could not tell you.
Well, the whole premise of your argument in Powell is that he wasn't. So you don't know the answer to that?
I would have told you, and I said at the beginning, no, he wasn't. And I placed it in the brief, and when the state responded, they did not say all the stuff that Mr. Giacomo said.
I don't care what they said in their brief. It's a matter of fact in the record. Was he arraigned on May 27th, yes or no?
Justice Hardesty, without looking at that record, I could not accurately answer that. If I tell you no, and I'm wrong.
Okay, we'll consult the record. Thank you.
Okay, well, thank you, Mr. Orme and Mr. Giacomo, for your excellent arguments and briefs. I'm glad to see we got a lot of younger attorneys here and all. I want you to know we had two outstanding attorneys here, and we appreciate you coming over and watching the arguments today with the court. So this matter will stand submitted, and we'll be in recess until the next call of the court. Mm-hmm.